Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 283 for April 17th, 2015. No love lost between me and my EV.
Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. As you can see, John is not here, and I am. And so we are doing something somewhat different. This is rather special that we have Mark Phelan of the Detroit Free Press here, and you've seen Mark before. Mark, how you doing?
Hi, everybody. I'm great. Thank you, Gary. Pleasure to be here.
It's always good to have you here. You always have some interesting insights. We also have Chris Pocker here, who is now an automotive freelancer for
a whole bunch of people. It's great to be back. Thank you.
And we appreciate you having here. And so here's the unusual special part. We have Aaron Gold, who is with cars.about.com. from Sherman Oaks via Skype, so you can probably see that nice little picture of Aaron. Aaron, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And did I say the name of your website correctly?
You did. Cars.about.com. It's part of the about.com network.
Okay.
Among others, I'm also competing with Chris for freelance work.
Yeah. Shh. So you guys should have the wrestling match later on in the show. Okay. So, I want to start talking about, now last week, for those of you who watched or listened, we talked a lot about the CT6. The CT6 was introduced at the New York Auto Show. It was Cadillac's new entry. And so what I want to do is start with, before we get to Mark to talk about this, because this was basically his idea, that we actually got a viewer sent in a note about me saying what Gary is missing from Cadillac CT6 is that this is their first shot across the bow to recapture the slogan, the standard of the world as the technology used to build the CT6 might mean the next SRX might have a curb weight of 3,500 to 3,700 pounds, and the ATS replacement in 2020 or 2021 might weigh under 3,000 pounds, as this means Cadillac vehicles will be fuel efficient by design. And that was Mike Ma from San Francisco. So one of the points we were making last week was the fact that the way Cadillac was emphasizing this vehicle, it was a technological tour de force, but I argued that it was a technological tour de force primarily in terms of welding and aluminum and adhesive, and not a technological tour de force like a Tesla, okay, which is aluminum and welding and adhesive, but all that other stuff, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. But I wouldn't want to take away from the dividends that innovative manufacturing can pay in an actual vehicle.
Right.
So it is a tremendously light vehicle. There's going to be a standard four-cylinder engine, a two-liter four-cylinder, in a car that's the size of an S-Class. That's
right.
Pretty remarkable. And Cadillac has a history in recent years of producing lightweight, good-performing vehicles.
No doubt.
So I think that's all very important. I think the problem is they've had vehicles that are both lightweight and good-performing and distinctively styled that aren't selling very well. And I'm not sure that the CT6 moves the needle that much in that regard. We'll have to wait and see.
So Mark, your point is the CT6 the vehicle that Cadillac needs, or does Cadillac need something that is not the CT6?
I think they need things that are not the CT6. I think that the CT6 looks very good on paper. I can't wait to drive it. I think the GM has made huge leaps in weight, which was one of their big problems for a while. So I think I will concede all of those points. However, even if you build the best conceivable S-Class 7 Series type car and you're a Cadillac, you're going to sell, what, 12,000 of them a year? That is not going to change the brand. It's not going to get the brand all of the new owners it needs. It will, you know, maybe get you a halo effect, you know, but I'm not even sold on that. Amazingly enough, General Motors luxury brand is way behind the rest of the luxury industry in SUVs. I mean, how does that happen? The Escalade is a terrific vehicle. I you could make an argument it is the best of its kind, better even than the Mercedes, you know, GL class. That is arguable. But the SRX is older than everything it competes with. They got nothing that could compete with an Audi Q7, the new Volvo XC90, a growing segment. They've got nothing smaller than the SRX. We all focus on the fact that their sedan sales are up or down a couple of points. We would not notice that at all if they were playing at all in the growth segment of the luxury industry, which is SUVs. Mm-hmm. That's where I think they should put their money first. Mm-hmm. Do the CT6 when you're rolling in money, you know, from all the SUVs mm-hmm. you've been selling.
Aaron, got anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's interesting that what Mark says, you know, the problem is General Motors going to do what they need to do, which is let Cadillac develop its own SUV? I mean, the one thing about the CT6 is, you know, the chances of it becoming a Buick, I think, or a Chevrolet are fairly low. Cadillac, if they're going to do an SUV right, I think they really need their own SUV. You can't just get away with gussying up a Suburban and turning it into, or a Tahoe and turning it into an Escalade. Are they going to want to invest that kind of money? I think the CT6 is a wonderful car. I think it's pretty bland looking, which is part of the problem. I think technologically it's fantastic. The interior is wonderful. But Mark makes a really good point. That's not exactly the growth segment, and it's very hard to wrest sales away from BMW and Mercedes, especially out here in California where everybody and their brother has an S-Class or a 7 Series. Mm.
I want to go back to your point, too, about the styling being a little on the milquetoast side. I mean, it's certainly an evolution of the other models that are currently in production. And Cadillac has done amazing, amazing concept cars in recent years.
Right.
Right. And if they could have made that thing look like the El Mirage, it might have been the styling statement that mm-hmm. they need to have that gravitas to conquest sales. It doesn't. I think it's perfectly good looking, but is it styling? Does it have that air about it that mm-hmm. that it needs to move the needle? And I think Tesla does that in different ways. It does that in terms of, you know, technology and being a new brand that people are excited about. It does it in terms of the powertrain. And frankly, it's a good-looking car. And it has different packaging than a normal vehicle of that size. And,
right.
And so it's got unique selling points. This, to me, is, you know, it looks like it could be the XTS replacement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking as someone who likes both the ATS and CTS a lot, I'm crazy about both of those cars. Whenever I walk past one on the street, I do a quick little double take, which one was that I just saw? Mm-hmm. And this does not feel like it moves the bar far in terms of the styling, as you're saying, either. If they had gone El Mirage, that might be a whole different thing, because that would be a car that jaws would drop.
That car's a rock star.
That's a Cadillac?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so speaking of all of the above that we've mentioned here, so we got another email that was sent in by someone who signs himself as GM Veteran, okay? He has his real name that was there, but I don't know that he wants to use it. And so he said, recent reports have stated that Cadillac will be discontinuing all of its current cars. Obviously, this is more than an attention-generating headline, the reflection of the absolute truth. Of course, we know the ATS and CTS will be replaced by the end of their planned life cycles by similar vehicles with new names, which he says are CT3 and CT4. Possibly, right? The XTS is said to be the first car discontinued in that it won't be replaced. I don't think I've heard an exact date, but speculation says it'll bow out at the end of the 2016 model year.
No, okay.
That seems a little early.
18-19 calendar, I'd say.
Okay. So then he goes on to say that according to Automotive News Stats, the XTS is the top-selling car in the Cadillac lineup in the U.S. market, both for the month of March and year to date. That doesn't say much for the two newer cars in the stable, ATS and CTS, and doesn't seem to support the phasing of the XTS out, at least not so soon. So, as all of you know, that I will look at these numbers to see what's what. So, yes, XTS sales through March are 6,209, which is up 5.6%. ATS sales through March were 5,824, down 20.4%. And CTS sales through March were 4,636, down 39.5%. So you have basically 6,200 XTSs being sold, 5,800 ATSs being sold, and 4,600 CTS is being sold through March.
And you probably have the fattest margins on the XTS.
And nobody gives any love to the XTS.
I will.
Well, how many of those XTSs are going to be taxicabs to replace town cars? I mean, the XTS, my feeling about the XTS is, you know, it's a nice enough car, but, you know, don't let the door hit you on the trunk lid on the way out. You know, it's well executed, but to me, it's not what a Cadillac needs to be. That's why I was so pleased to see the CT6. There is a proper Cadillac flagship. The XTS, to me, is a very nice Buick.
I don't know that they ever really looked at the XTS as the flagship, despite the fact that it's the largest vehicle. I think it is the holdover model from Cadillac customers of yore.
It's the one for the old guys who still wish you were making a DeVille.
Right. And I think there's still an audience for that, as those specs show. And I think it's a perfectly nice vehicle for that, with the exception of Q, because I don't think elderly buyers want to mess with something that complicated.
All right. So what GM veteran goes on to say, which is to this point you're just making, is saying perhaps the American public doesn't care so much that a luxury car is rear drive versus front wheel drive. So XTS is a front drive car, right? So it's not a rear drive car, and everybody says, oh, you can't have an electric car unless it's rear drive, right?
Tell that to Audi.
Or perhaps Americans like the larger size of the XTS versus the two smaller cars, and there is more of a post-DTS market than the product planners at Cadillac predicted.
No, no, no. People are obsessing over the ATS and the CTS, their combined sales going up or down 10 units every month. What they're forgetting is that those are two cars playing in the field where one car was before, just the CTS. The CTS before, it was a tweener. It was priced like a 3 Series. It was the size of a 5 Series. It was a very good car, particularly at that price. You know, Cadillac, you know, it helped Cadillac get established, and they got established enough to get to the point where they said, we can now go head-to-head. The ATS is the 3 Series. The CTS is the 5 Series. So they've got two cars replacing one. Of course, each of them is selling less than the one that was covering all that space was before. I mean,
sure,
that was just going to happen.
Yeah, that's true. But they're not picking up ground is the thing. I mean, they're not building their brands and moving forward.
Well, that gets back to my SUV point.
If they
had a good SRX replacement and a Q7, nobody would notice.
Okay. It's shocking that they don't. I mean, even Acura, which we can, you know, carp about how well their cars are selling, their SUV lines are going great guns, and they are fantastic vehicles, and they're keeping that brand going.
See, and so actually, so while those numbers through March looked damn good for the XTS, if we go back to last year for the entire 2014, the CTS sold 31,000 and change. The ATS sold approximately 30,000, and the XTS was down at 24,000 and change. So they're getting some traction in that space. Okay, happening.
Can I be the one person to say something good about the XTS as well? I mean, because of the kind of car it is, it will never be taken seriously by the buyer's Cadillac needs, and I understand, and that's why it will go out. But it's a lot of car for the money, and you get the all-wheel drive with the twin-turbo V6, and it's a very compelling package.
You said the car that Cadillac needs for buyers, but is there not a cadre of people who are just Cadillac buyers who want the DTS and now they buy the XTS?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody
wants...
But are
they the bigger slice of the market?
Yeah.
I have never, here in California, I don't think I've yet to see an XTS outside of the press launch that didn't have a TCP and a number written on the bumper, which means it's a taxi cab. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've always held that the most important thing for a luxury brand is... It's not so much the content of the vehicles, it's the image of the brand. Do people want to drop their keys down on the, you know, on the table and see a Cadillac badge on the key fob? That's what it really comes down to.
But you're in Sherman Oaks, and it's all snooty out there, and we have beat-up Crown Vicks that are cabs here. So it's a whole different world.
But the XTS devalues the brand in that sense that Aaron's saying, even though it is a terrific car. I will say that to anybody. It's a terrific car. But it's a car that people look at and they kind of dismiss because they think it's the same as the DTS and the DeVille and the STS and all of those. Mm-hmm. And Cadillac's existential question is, how do they transfer some of those buyers to the new vehicles? Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to walk away from that because, you know, I mean, they'll come and say, give me one with every option every 2 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I still like the idea of no excuses, no apologies, American luxury, like the barge kind of thing, like the big cushy ride. The funny thing is, you know, look at the Lincoln concept from the New York show. Sort of that vibe, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if anything, it has some Bentley styling bits and all of that, but it seems to be about plush first and dynamics later.
Right.
But in part because they're stuck with a platform that limits them.
True.
I mean...
You mean Lincoln.
Lincoln is stuck with, yeah. I mean, you know, Lincoln has yet to show us the platform that will allow them to do the same things Cadillac is competing
dynamically. Is trying to do, yeah.
Well, no, I think, you know, they haven't convinced people that they are a dynamic match for BMW yet, but I think probably most of us would at least say they're in the ballpark. I think some of the vehicles are better, it's, you know, but it's a conversation about Cadillac. It's not one about Lincoln at this point.
And then, so last but not least, we'll leave it on here, and you mentioned this a little bit, and he also goes on to say that he's surprised that the bestseller in the brand is the oldest one, the SRX. So I looked at the SRX sales through March, 12,000 and change, which is basically double the sales of the XTS, and, you know, just,
well, if I...
and 53,578 last year sold, which is number one by far that anything Cadillac sells. Aaron.
You know, the SRX, it may be getting a little on the old side, but that's not a bad car. I mean, that comes out of an era when Cadillac was doing some really fantastic things. I happen to think the last generation CTS still looks fantastic, and I drool when I see the coupe to this day. The SRX, I mean, it's a little dated in some places, but it's really not a bad product at all. It would be nice to see them replace it. Well, it would be nice to see them replace it with some of the more modern technology, although I could do without Q. And I could do without something that looks exactly like a CTS. Like Mark, I mean, we tell these things apart for a living, and I can't tell the new ATS from the CTS. But the SRX is basically, old as it is, still, I think, a good car. It's like their Volvo XC90, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent point. So that segment is white hot, and it's still growing share. But the most prominent vehicles in that segment are not new vehicles. We just saw the new Lexus RX. But that vehicle is an older vehicle. It's not particularly accomplished dynamically. It's not that engaging.
And that's the reason that Cadillac was able to let the SRX age as much as they
did,
I think. Because the RX, the Lexus RX, defines that segment.
Yeah.
But now it's been replaced, and we haven't seen the new SRX yet, so I want to see the new SRX. But I agree with Aaron. It's a very good vehicle. The one place where it has become badly uncompetitive, I think, is fuel economy.
Yes.
Right now, the SRX, but it's still, you know, one that, you know, I wouldn't argue with anybody who wanted to buy it.
All right, so we've had Aaron, you've bitched about it. Q. So let's explain to people who may not be familiar with what Q is. I mean, we're just throwing it out there, like, you know, and they might think it's an Audi.
Ah, yeah, fair enough. So it's their
or an Infiniti.
It's their infotainment system, and it's the manner in which you operate most of the major functions within the vehicle, whether it's navigation or your HVAC, and it's beautiful to look at. It's stunning. There's a in-cluster display that you can fiddle with the switches on the steering wheel, and you can pull up different functions on the left and on the right and customize it. It's a very powerful system, and it's great to look at. You get in the car. I'm sure it sells cars because you sit down and it makes the big swooshing sound and the graphics come on and you go, wow, this is the future. And then you try and use it in a moving environment. And they've been having quality problems. I mean, you were talking before the show.
A friend of mine who has a Cadillac is running close to one service visit a month purely because of Q. And these are multiple day service events. I mean, he can't adjust the climate control. He can't change the temperature. He can't make hands-free calls. Stuff that's completely unacceptable. It's the reliability. The interface, too many touch panel stuff, not enough dials. That's part of the problem. But the reliability is a problem, too. And I think General Motors has got terrific voice recognition, which I initially thought offset the problems with Q, but the problems with Q just seem to be multiplying.
Well, and if it's not just a usability issue, the fact is if it's braking and it's forcing people to go to the dealers, I've had issues where the screen freaks out and it won't shut off, that, you know, when the rest of the car shuts off in press vehicles. And, you know, these are new vehicles. So if there are those level of problems, of course it's going to absolutely grenade your JD Power scores. We've got a question here, or a comment, I should say, from Wright Knight, who said, Cadillac's biggest mistake was going front-wheel drive with their lineup. Cadillac needs to bring back the L as a softer riding option in the middle of their naming scheme. I think that's an interesting thought. I think their biggest mistake is Q.
I think saying their biggest mistake was, you know, was front-wheel drive is like saying electing Nixon was a mistake. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
You know? But...
No, but to your point, Chris, that Q is your biggest mistake, but you said that when somebody gets in the car and they're like, oh my God, look at this. This is fantastic. I want to buy a car that has this.
I think that happens once. With some buyers.
Well, right.
Well, but that once is enough for a lot of people. But I also think for traditional buyers, it's probably really off-putting, especially the switchgear, the lack thereof. I mean, they've got the haptic feedback switches and the sliders and no traditional volume knob. And you guys have heard us all, talk about the glory of volume and tuning knob. You're probably all sick of hearing it by now. Automotive journalists all like to carp about it all the time. But
and the
reality is...
CT6 does not appear to have those.
Yeah.
So they're not learning as fast as you might like.
So,
no.
So they don't have what?
They do not have volume or tuning. On the photos of the interior so far, they do have actual switches for climate control, temperature and fan. But volume and tuning appear to still be touchscreen sliders.
And I don't get that, because we've seen automakers adopt these highly powerful... all new sort of infotainment systems. We had the original iDrive, right? It was one pork pie hat, and it pushed down and went 80 million directions. And then what do they do? In subsequent generations, they back out more and more functions into hard keys, hard buttons. Mm-hmm. And then look at Sync, right? Now there's actual traditional redundant
Lincoln
controls.
Has gone back to
and what's
knob.
Interesting is in the new Edge, they used to use the capacitive touch panels, which is what Cadillac has. It's not a button, it's a plastic panel. I can't stand the things, because you're trying to do one thing and the bottom of your hand hits another button. The new Edge, which is supposed to be designed for more techie people, went back to actual buttons that you push, and I'm very happy. That's my least favorite thing about
So Kia. Aaron, with your happiness, we're going to leave your happiness there, and we're going to take a break for our friends at Bridgestone Firestone.
Hey! Did you have a good nap?
The Firestone Destination LE2. Tough enough to handle anything the road throws at you.
Oops.
And you throw at it. Durable, dependable Firestone tires. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay, and we are back, and we're going to continue on with our discussion of things related to Cadillac, and we're going to go back to Wright Knight's question. Part of it was it was front-wheel drive, he thought was a mistake, and then the L.
Right.
So, Mark, you have a comment about the L.
I think that's a great idea. I think as Cadillac tries to reach out to newer, more performance-oriented customers, having a model of each car or some cars that says, yes, I am the soft, old, quiet Cadillac that that strikes me as a really good idea.
And is that for the guys who are
buying XTSs today?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So give them something more specific to the point.
Yeah.
Because
do
it's
an
sort
L
of,
version.
It seems to me that basically, if you look at what Cadillac is doing, is they're more worried about V than they are worried about L, right?
Because you'll get headlines with V, you're not going to get it with L.
Right.
Yeah.
But isn't it conceivable that you'll sell more cars with an L than you will with a V?
Yeah. Or you just don't put the L on the back, but you make a softly sprung suspension an option.
Mm-hmm. And you make sure people know it's there.
I think part of the problem is it's the influencers who love the Vs.
Right.
Because personally, I'm actually, it drives me bonkers that every luxury car has to be a BMW clone. If I was going to buy, if I had the money to buy several cars, I'd have something fun to drive on the weekends. I'd get the softest sprung Mercedes E-Class I could get to sit in LA traffic.
So basically what you're saying is that it's people who are like people that are at this table and on that Skype screen that are the ones who are just saying, oh, you need to have this driving performance and dynamics and horsepower and torque and...
Well, and I mean, the funny thing now is with electronics being the way they are and with things like magnetic ride control, you can just do some rearranging of ones and zeros and you can create that softer model without necessarily investing in anything more than a different set of tires and some, maybe soften up the tuning on the steering or whatever. So it's easily done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of, while you're targeting that market, that literally probably dying out market of XTS buyers, are those buyers going to turn off the younger, edgier, import buyers that Cadillac seems to want so desperately?
Mm-hmm. So speaking of things with the letter L in them, and speaking of Cadillac, Cadillac announced this week that it is significantly lowering the price of the ELR, which is not been selling very well.
Front-wheel drive mistakes.
To go to the ELR now, that is their version of the Volt, which they probably would not like me saying out loud, but that's basically what it is. So as those of you who are keeping score at home, when I mentioned before about the, say, XTS sales being 6,200 through March, the sales of the ELR through March are 311. And last year...
How many of those are executives?
And last year, Cadillac sold 1,310. So it was a very, very refined, limited number of vehicles. I love the ELR.
Me too.
I think it's a fantastic car. I like it more than I like the XT.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Has there ever been a more badly mangled launch than that car? They told people that it was going to cost $72,000, I think, was the base price at the time.
Went on sale January 2014 at $75,995. That includes $995 for delivery, so it's a $75,000 car.
So they told people it was a $75,000 car 3 months before anybody had driven it, had the opportunity to sit in it, and tell people, you know, this is not just a Cadillac badge on a Volt. So the first reaction from everybody writing about it was Cadillac Volt to cost $30,000 more than Chevrolet Volt. So,
right.
I mean, you don't recover from that, mm-hmm. I don't think. I'm with you. I think it's a beautiful car. I think the interior is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a sports car. You know, fine, don't be a sports car if you don't want to be. It's closer to plush in some ways,
right.
The ride. But, I mean, the technology is terribly impressive.
Mm-hmm.
It deserves a better fate than it has gotten, I think. And
right.
I'll be really interested to see, especially the price move, because that's
right.
Magic.
So basically, so what they're doing is that, okay, we earlier said that it was starting at 75. Now it'll start at 65, and then as they're pointing out, that you get probably a $7,500 tax credit for the car. So you'll now be getting a ELR for on the order of $58,495.
My fear is that that's actually not that different than what the cars were transacting at right now.
There's some pretty heavy discounts.
There are some major discounts for that car because they've been sitting around. Dealers are tying up an awful lot of cash in those vehicles. I think it's gorgeous. I think it's one of the best styling statements out of General Motors in a really long time. I think it has a fantastic interior, Q accepted. But
it's an asterisk.
But I don't think it's a very good vehicle. I really don't. I didn't enjoy driving it that much. I think its body is saying one thing, and its performance says something completely different. I think it's catastrophically priced. Even now, I don't think it's going to move the needle that much. I think the damage has probably already been done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with you. I do think the damage is done. The interesting thing to me about this price is that at the moment I'm driving a BMW i3 with their range extender, which costs about $53,000. And one could very easily make an argument that it shows the ELR to be a pretty good buy in some ways. And I like the i3. It's a very impressive car in a lot of ways.
All right, so you're saying that the $50,000 i3 that you're driving right now is technologically or physically or existentially or...
At least two of the above.
All right.
Okay, I'll give you one. The interior of the ELR is beautiful and very luxurious.
Mm-hmm.
The interior of the i3 looks like it's made out of recycled burlap bags. And that is what they were going for.
By design, okay.
That is by design.
It actually is made out of recycled burlap bags.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, thank you. And what I think is...
With some driftwood.
Yeah, and the driftwood really does look good. And that's a choice that you make, right or wrong, it's your choice to make. The place where I think there becomes a qualitative reason to say, man, the ELR looks kind of good all of a sudden, is that it is a range-extended vehicle in which you can drive from Detroit to Los Angeles and just stop for gas every 300-400 miles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you drain the battery and you're in extended range, using it as a generator mode. The BMW is also an extended range vehicle, but the farthest you can conceivably go on the extended range is another 75 miles. So basically, it's a 2.4-gallon gas tank.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, you'll never put 2.4 gallons in that tank. I drove one all the way from Bay Harbor and all the way down. And
so Bay Harbor is in northern Michigan, for those of you who are not familiar with our beautiful
state.
It's
hundreds of miles from where we are. And it was literally stopping, you know, every 1.6 gallons worth of fuel. and I had...
And 1.6 gallons in this is around 50, 55 miles per
Right, probably. Correct. And I had some really interesting moments in that vehicle where the power just cut out because it's a very flat drive. And what keeps the powertrain at full boil is having the ability to recharge the battery when you're on descents or when you're using braking. So if you're steady state on the freeway, you don't get those opportunities. Mm-hmm. So there were times where I'd be going along at 70 miles an hour, and it really didn't even give me the information on the readout. And all of a sudden, I would lose power, and I was down to 50, 55 miles an hour, and you know, semi-trucks are running right up in my grill. BMW has since said they're updating that. In fact, they may already have that update on the market now. And I think
they're updating it as we speak.
As we speak from the cloud, yes. And I think it's a really interesting vehicle. I completely get what you're saying. The ELR, because it has much longer range, is a more of an everyday vehicle. But I think the i3 is specifically, philosophically, and in terms of execution, a city vehicle.
It is, and a fast
even with the extended range.
Yeah.
Right. So
if I could say,
Aaron, go.
I think if you're buying an i3 and relying on the range extender, I think you're not in the right car. Although I would kind of say the same thing for a Volt. You know, I think as journalists, we tend to concentrate too much on the range issue. I've been driving a lot of electric cars recently. Not a lot. A lot meaning two. But I think we focus too much on the range issue and not realize that driving an electric vehicle is really a different lifestyle choice. You kind of learn to live your life around a 70 to 110 mile battery, just as we now, you know, kind of live our lives around a 300 mile fuel tank. Mm-hmm. And for the record, there is absolutely no love lost between me and the i3. I haven't driven the range extender yet. I've driven the battery only version and have very little good to say about it beyond the design. But to be fair, I don't think it's fair to evaluate that car and how it does on a 200 mile trip. I think those range extenders are really to be thought about how, you know, when things go brutally wrong, which they rarely do if you charge up at home, you know, how are you going to have your bacon saved, as it were? Mm-hmm.
I think the most interesting thing to come out of this, though, is that basically Mark said that Cadillac has a car that's better than a BMW, and that Cadillac really ought to push that, I think, because we established earlier that they're really concerned with BMW.
Well,
they are. They've got a winner.
I had not actually thought of it in those terms. The one thing that I do want to say is that I like the i3. And unless pieces start falling off of it, the i3 is going to get a good review. But I think
when I was coming in from the parking lot, Mark, there was just a pile of
driftwood.
I think the i3 has some inherent limitations to it, which put the Volt and the ELR in a somewhat more positive light than they may be seen otherwise.
There's always trade-offs. So the range is definitely a trade-off. But in the terms of the ELR,
They're going to have this new powertrain. It's going to be the new Volt powertrains.
Right, it'll be a little quicker and
the performance
will be a little bit more becoming of something so gorgeous that looks like a GT car and isn't. Mm-hmm. But there's no real rear seat in the ELR. The trunk space in the ELR, while it's slightly larger than the Volt, has a male slot of an opening. It's not practical. Whereas something like the i3 is. I think they're just different vehicles, and I think because we're still at a time where having range-extended vehicles or having pure electrics is still such a new thing, and there aren't enough different models to have them all file neatly into classes, we're sort of making these comparisons and saying, well, how does this compare with the Tesla Model S and the i8? You know, and those vehicles are two completely different things.
All right, I got a completely different one. Another news that General Motors made this week, that Chevrolet announced that the Spark EV 1LT will have a new MSRP of $25,995, and that is going to be eligible for federal tax credit of $7,500. And this is where it gets interesting. California and Maryland Spark EV owners may also qualify for a $2,500 rebate, $2,500 from California, $2,300 excise tax exemption in Maryland. There's other bonus cash available, $1,000 in California, $1,200 in Maryland, $3,500 in Oregon. After full federal and state tax credits and Chevrolet bonus cash, the Spark EV could be as low as $14,995. OK, pay for an electric vehicle?
I heard Aaron moan at some point during that. I want to hear what Aaron's thinking.
I just drove. Now, for the record, for those who aren't familiar, I think I'm the only automotive journalist who said anything nice about Mitsubishi in the past 2 years.
Yeah,
but,
you are.
but I just drove the iMiEV, which is their little egg-shaped electric car, and they cut the price about 2 years ago. Now, the iMiEV has been such a slow seller. There has not been an odd model year iMiEV. They've had to skip them. There's only been a 12, a 14, and a 16. But it's true. But
that's the way they count in the future. It's more binary.
Yeah, exactly. It's a zero or a one. No, we sell cars. We don't sell cars. But you know, I did a couple of reviews of this car. I think I made almost enough money reviewing it to buy one. They cut the price to $23,800. $7,500 off makes it a $16,500 car, and it comes down more in California. I think in Georgia, which has some amazing incentives. I remember correctly, Georgia is like something like 10% up to $5,000 or five. Anyway, it's a $12,000 car in Georgia, and it's interesting because you now have what is essentially an electric car for the price of a Honda Fit or a Hyundai Accent or something like that. You give up some features, and you ask, is it worth it? And you know, electric cars. I think the things people ignore is that they cost so much.
You can't see him shaking his head here when you're
when you asked if it was worth it. I'm sitting there with a big shaking.
Oh my God! It was
no.
Yeah, I've heard. I didn't mind. Well, I drove it. The last one I drove was an iMiEV, and now I'm driving a Kia Soul EV, which I regard to be a very nice electric car. So I have sort of a study in contrast. But although I have to say, being able to charge nearly fully on a quick charger in 15 minutes, which you can in the iMiEV, pretty darn cool. If the quick charger hasn't overheated by then. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're getting to the point where you can get a cheap electric car for the cost of a cheap gas car. And don't forget electricity costs. Around here, the people I know who own EVs, they figure about $1 a day to fuel the thing or to power the thing. And, you know, the maintenance schedule, I read the manual on the Mitsubishi. The maintenance schedule is new cabin filter every 15,000 miles. And that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, these are and it's interesting. Now, the Spark is, I think, a nicer and a neater car than the iMiEV is. So that's why I groaned, because for them to come down so far in price, well, so long to my little egg-shaped iMiEV.
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting that one of the things that they say is that compared to the average new gas-powered vehicle, the Spark EV can save drivers on average about $83 a month in fuel costs, according to EPA assessments based on 24 miles per gallon highway for average vehicle, okay? And then they compare that to the cost of electricity. So I was looking at that 24 miles per gallon highway, and I thought, this is odd, because you can buy a normal Spark.
But they said average vehicles. That's
right,
the caveat.
Okay, but if you,
they're comparing it to F-150s.
because a normal Spark has 39 miles per gallon highway. So you're not saving so much.
That's another one I just drove. My cheap car article, my most inexpensive car articles is very popular at about.com. So I know my inexpensive cars. We just drove a gas-powered Spark for a week down in New York. We averaged 35 miles per gallon out of the car, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, because it's 31, 39, 30, 39.
We averaged spot on 35 right. with New York traffic.
But you don't get all that electric torque.
Well, yeah, you get a hell of a lot of torque in the electric Spark. But, you know, I found in the electric cars, I mostly drive them in eco mode just to see how far I can stretch my range. But, you know, there's a lot of things that people don't quite get about electric cars. And I think one of them is the concept of never going to a gas station ever. And the other one is never changing the oil, never worrying about overheating, never changing the fluids. They're virtually maintenance-free. There's a lot I really am kind of a fan of electric car ownership, even though I miss V8s going blah, 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 and things like that. They really are pretty neat. I mean, the cost, people who get them are surprised. That's where I thought the Volt would really take off, because people would realize just how far 40 miles was and realize they really don't need much gasoline. I hear that from Volt owners. They gas up a lot less than they thought, but, you know, the Volt wasn't as successful as I predicted it would be, so.
Well, to be fair, we often on the show we don't talk about Nissan for whatever reason, and I think we had to bring them in the conversation because of the Nissan Leaf. And so, I mean, for those who are not familiar with the Spark is a mini car. It is a very small car. And the Leaf is arguably a compact car, right? I mean,
sure.
it's a normal sized car.
Compared to a Civic.
So the Spark EV has gasoline equivalency of 119 miles per gallon. The Leaf has 114 miles per gallon E. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so here's a car that you either have a sort of a normal sized compact car Leaf, which starts at $29,010, and then you get all those. You know, if you buy it in Georgia, I guess they'll give you money to take it or something, right, Aaron? You know,
and, yeah.
And so,
son. What you driving with them fur and electric cars for?
You just lost all the viewers in Atlanta. I just want to tell you that. So, I mean, it's sort of interesting that you have, you know, these two very different cars. And so, I mean...
But you're comparing two different classes as if they're the same class.
Well, but again...
We wouldn't do if it was a midsize car and a compact, but right. Because there's so few electrics.
Everything is up
Chris's
for grabs.
Point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which is kind of what I was doing with BMW and ELR, which is not a fair apples to apples either.
Right. And the Leaf is available everywhere. And the Spark EV, I don't believe, is still available in every market. I could be wrong about that, but I think it's still pretty limited in where they're putting it. Same with the Soul EV. And it is the Leaf is a car that has a nicer interior, and it's more capacious. It's something that you could live with every day.
Seats five.
But I think with a lot of these people, when they're buying the small city cars, they're using them as third cars. So they're the option, I just want to run to the store really quickly. That's why people originally bought smart cars as handbags, you know, and as fashion statements and as that occasional used car. Didn't matter that they had two other full-size cars at home. And I think that's primarily what people are still using most of these cars for.
Mm-hmm.
I would, at least out here in La La Land, I would disagree. Somebody told me that the Tesla is like the Beverly Hills Camry. It's kind of the same with Leafs. They're all over the place. One note about the Leaf, by the way, Leaf has multiple trim levels. See, these are the details we're going to learn to dive into as journalists. Cheapest Leaf, gets a slower charger. So it's 7 hours to charge a base model Leaf, 4 hours to charge a mid-level Leaf. You get the bigger charger, the same as you get on a Kia Soul or a Volkswagen e-Golf. The Soul is a nicer size car to live with. I happened to be at a charging station this morning and was comparing the Soul EV with this woman's Leaf. She was checking out the Kia and comparing it to her Leaf. So you do get more trunk room in the Leaf, although she was thinking that the back seat of the Soul would be better for the baby that they were expecting. But you know, we're going to have to look at different things. MPG that Gary mentioned earlier is interesting. It's basically how efficient is the car, and some electric cars are more efficient than others. But the cost to fill up are so cheap that the difference of 10 MPGE is almost too small to worry about. You know, better to look at what's the range, how much do your accessories draw down, and how much warning do you get? You know, do you get minimalistic warning of how far you can go? Or do you get something that really lets you analyze how to stretch your mileage that much further?
Mm-hmm. And so before we stretch this any further, we need to take another break. And we're going to have a word from our friends at Hank Holmes.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
Okay, and we're back, and we have a phone call that has come in. So, Ben, please bring in the call.
Yeah, my name is Clem Zarofsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. We're talking about the advantage of the electric car being cheaper to operate. The biggest cost for any automobile you buy today is depreciation, and the depreciation rate of these electric cars is 50% more than a gas car. So I can't believe anybody's trying to sell on the fact that you're going to save money by driving one. Thank you.
Good point, and I think that, you know, we've seen an explosion in Fiat 500e sales here in California, and I think a big part of that is they're leasing them, and the lease price. I mean, the cars are almost free. The lease rates are so low, and I bumped into a lot of people because I don't have my own charger. I'm using the CHAdeMO quick charger network, so I'm bumping into a lot of people who are quick charging their Leafs, and the quick charging is a little rough on the batteries. And a lot of them are saying, "Well, you know, I lease the car, so I don't care what kind of condition the battery's in 3 years."
Right.
And that speaks to whether automakers are – we don't really expect that they're making profits on these vehicles yet. There's the famous Sergio Marchionne 500E quote about, you know, I hope you don't buy the car because it's costing me, what was it, $12,000 or $15,000 every time somebody buys one?
Right. That's part of what disrupts the whole market, too, because there are some companies that are building them because they have to sell them, and they only sell them in California, and there are others that are building them because they think there's a business model like the Leaf or the Volt, and it's a very weird market right now. Mm-hmm.
But Clem has an excellent point. I do think you have to factor in, if you're going to buy the vehicle, what it's going to be worth at the end, especially if you don't, you're not one of those people that runs the vehicle into the ground. And it'll probably take a very long time indeed to run an EV into the ground, assuming you're willing to re-up the battery pack at some point.
I have to say, Clem said that the residual value of EVs, you know, falls off very quickly. I'm not aware of that one way or the other.
Oh, no, it's true. It's very true. I think it's particularly true for models like the Leaf. I think he's right. They were substantially lower, like 8-10 points lower. Than everything else, or even more. Going back to the 500E, I think that if you do have really attractive lease rates and you make it acceptable, like either as a primary or secondary car because it's $110 a month or whatever, with little money down, it's a great option. And it helps that the 500E is probably the best 500 in terms of the way it drives. Certainly, maybe not compared to the Abarth, but you know, compared to the standard gas version, I find it to be a much better vehicle to drive.
I like the 500E better than any of those cars. Yeah. But speaking of Fiat Chrysler Automotive Group, there's this whole concern about whether or not they will find a partner, or they will be purchased by somebody, or they will merge with somebody. Apparently, last month, Sergio Marchionne said a combination with General Motors or Ford is, and I quote, technically feasible. Last year there was some talk about whether or not Volkswagen might show interest in getting what is now FCA. Apparently a equity research firm came out in March and was saying that there was a possibility that it might tie up with Peugeot. What do you guys think?
Well, saying that a merger with Ford or General Motors is technically feasible is completely meaningless because neither of them would do it in a million years. So, I mean, that's just Sergio being Sergio.
Okay.
He's an interesting, smart guy who talks a lot, and that's him. You want to take a shot at the next one?
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly right. What I would say is that he loves to stir the pot, and that gets that conversational ball rolling, right? And if there's any executives that are out there thinking, well, you know, I probably could stand a shack up with somebody, that's, you know, that's his way of forwarding the agenda that the industry is still waiting for more consolidation to happen. He's, you know, wanted to, or he's wanted to combine with more automakers, maybe not on a merger basis, but on individual products. And I think we're going to see more of that sort of small on individual models, that sort of basis for a while. There are players that are going out there alone, like Mazda, that are, you know, seem to be making that work right now while the yen is in, you know, in their favor.
Wouldn't they be a nice partner, though? Because I look at Fiat Chrysler, I think they're big enough in Europe and North America that it's hard to picture anybody else who's a huge player in either of those markets being a partner. But somebody Asian.
They'd probably be a nice partner.
Mitsubishi?
but I enjoy Mazda vehicles so much, and I enjoy that largely as a product of their corporate culture. And so I hope that they don't, you know, merge with anybody beyond an individual vehicle basis. I don't mind that the Miata is co-developing a Fiat model. But if it's the whole company, you know, you worry about the strength of the corporate culture.
And if I was going to put $5 of my own money on it, I would say one of the Indian companies, I would think more likely than Mazda, just because there's even less overlap.
So were you talking in terms of an Indian company, who might you think this would be?
Well, there's two Indian car companies that matter, Tata and Mahindra.
Mm-hmm.
Tata seems to be pretty damn well run. And I mean,
so they own Jaguar Land Rover now.
Land Rover, they've done a great job with those two brands.
Mm-hmm.
Mahindra thinks of itself as Tata's, you know, huge, you know, competitor. They've got nothing basically outside of India right now. They've got, you know, a lot of money. They've got volume. So I would feel more comfortable trying to line up the pieces so that they fit with either of those companies than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's clear that Sergio wants to hook up with somebody.
Right.
And the Volkswagen stuff, I think, is kind of crazy. Volkswagen's got more than enough problems of its own without, you know, taking on Fiat and Chrysler.
So, Aaron, you got anything you want to say about this possibility of FCA getting together with someone?
I'm hoping for Peugeot because I haven't been able to drive a 306 in 20 years, and I really miss it.
And so the
Indians make sense. I would think the French would take any opportunity they could to get a foothold in the States, although, you know, it seems they haven't Renault-ized too many of the Nissans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have some questions that came in from our audience.
Yes, we do, although not necessarily germane to the EV conversation.
We'll just change subject. What the hell?
And to this merger conversation, more toward the EV. Scaling back a little bit, Maverick has a question. He says, why is the new Malibu capable of better highway miles per gallon than the new Volt with the extended range engine running?
I'm assuming that's based on the 1.5 turbo engine that they talked about in the Malibu.
I believe so.
That's what I would think. I mean, you guys know how it is with turbos. You know, real world mileage may vary a lot. The Volt is still naturally aspirated. I mean, again, I never like mileage conversations with the Volt because it really kind of, that's not really what the car is all about. But, you know, hey, listen, if you can hold a steady 65 miles an hour with the turbo not generating any boost, then you get 1 billion miles per gallon. If you have to get into the turbo, then, you know, you're going to be getting 25 miles per gallon. It's the same problem with Ford. I've never had any luck getting real-world fuel economy out of the turbocharged Fords anywhere close to what was said with what the EPA said the cars would get, with the exception of the very big engine, you know, the 3.5 liter EcoBoost, which doesn't need that much EcoBoost.
And building on what Aaron said, I think conversations about highway fuel economy in extended range mode about the Volt really are missing the point of the Volt. The point of the Volt is that you can go 40 miles or so, 50 with the new powertrain on battery power, no gasoline at all. And then if you do need to go farther, you got the extended range.
Right.
I think that's more the Volt's, you know, proposition.
You know, it's sort of interesting that the new Malibu hybrid is based on Volt developed technology. So that's a...
Well, as I understand the mechanicals, and I'm not a real expert here, and I would defer to Mark or Chris, but as I understand, the mechanical arrangement of the Volt is actually fairly similar to the Prius. You know, it's a power split transmission, whereas you'd expect it to be more like the Honda Accord hybrid, where you've got a motor generator generating electricity for another motor, and then only clutching them together under certain circumstances. But I understand the bits are the same with the power split. It's just a matter of how you connect you connect what.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We got another one.
Not on either of these subjects. If you'd like to.
Oh, let's just.
Okay. Going back to Cadillac.
The experts here. You guys can ask about anything or answer about anything. So
going back to Cadillac, Marion Kershavelin, I apologize if I'm butchering your name, asks, if Cadillac is making a comeback, will Lincoln be able to make the same?
Great question. Aaron, go.
My first thought is that, are you kidding me? Yes, if Lincoln hires everybody away from Cadillac. You know, it's funny. Lincoln doesn't have a – I think the Lincoln products aren't bad. I mean, I think the MKC is really good. That was my favorite for North American Utility of the Year, and I got outvoted by everybody else. But I think they could use some improvements to the interior. I think the bigger problem is that the pricing is a little too high. I think when you don't have a name that is really desirable, I think you need to buy a little market share. There's nothing wrong with that. But I don't think the two would necessarily be tied together. I mean, I think Cadillac, aside from the styling on the last couple of cars, ATS, CTS, the newest versions, I think Cadillacs are amazing. The driving dynamics of those cars are really, really wonderful. GM doesn't get nearly enough credit for their ability to build a really good chassis. Ever since the CTS-V, the last generation CTS-V was the car that made me realize, wow, they really get it. And in all their rear drive cars, they build in a natural handling balance as opposed to the Chrysler products, the Charger and the Challenger, where you're really relying on the electronics to take over and save you when the chassis lets go. Cadillac is brilliant, brilliant on-road engineering. And this from a company that was building overstuffed, you know, waterbeds 25 years ago. It's amazing how far they've come.
Yeah, but didn't I hear earlier that you guys wanted overstuffed waterbeds to drive around?
I'll take an overstuffed waterbed, but the problem is there's what people think they want versus what they really want. You know, anybody who owns a BMW and rents a Cadillac, rented a Cadillac DTS or a DeVille is going to say, oh, these people are hopeless, you know. Now, granted, they may get into CTS and think it's hopeless anyway because they're so tied into their prejudices. Mm-hmm. I had this once with a friend who swore he'd never buy an American car. A friend of ours then rented a Pontiac Vibe. And I said, all right, tell me what you don't like about this car. And he sat in the driver's seat, he pointed out all the flaws in the interior. He said, this is typical American. I said, typical American? He said, yeah. I said, ha, it's a Toyota. And I told him, this is, you're sitting in a Toyota cabin. It's those prejudices that people have. So, you know, I always used to say that, I once got to say it to Bob Lutz, that GM has to do things twice as good to get half the recognition. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, Toyota could build a Camry out of
Did
compressed
he kiss
squirrel
you after
turds.
That?
What's that?
Did he kiss you?
No, I can't repeat what he said on – he did not kiss me. Well, I said Toyota could build a Camry out of compressed squirrel turds and people would buy it. And he goes, yeah, the car melted in the rain, but I still love it. That was what he said.
All right, Mark was going to say something about Cadillac.
No, I was going to say something about Lincoln,
actually.
Lincoln, all right. I think that another way of looking at the question, the definition of success for Lincoln is very different from what it is for Cadillac. Lincoln – right now, if Lincoln could be considered equivalent to Acura – that would be a massive improvement for Lincoln, I think. So, I mean, they're starting from a much lower base, and they have less ambitious goals. Although Chris is right, for a lower base and less ambitious goals, there's nothing shy about their pricing. Mm-hmm. You know.
So okay, here's a question to all you guys about Lincoln and to some extent Cadillac. I mean, does it matter if they're successful in the U.S. market, or does it matter if they're successful in China?
Yes, both.
But I mean,
yeah.
But
China's where the money is. But come on, we're an American car company. There's got to be some home market pride. I mean, if you're
GM, they have some home market pride. But I mean, just look at it from the point of view of, you know, the first law of the auto industry is make money. Okay, and it seems that the market is there. In China.
Yeah, China's the number one market for luxury vehicles in the world. Where's the number two market?
Here or Germany?
The number two is the U.S. So, I mean, just in terms of volume, you want to be big in both places.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
All right, but okay, yeah. If you can't pull both off.
You want to be big in China. But the question is, can you be big in China without having a decent-sized presence in the U.S.? And the argument...
That's Buick.
Right, that was the argument about keeping Buick, when everybody was like, well, why are you keeping Buick as opposed to some of these other brands? When GM was going through the bankruptcy, and the argument was always, well, it's going great guns in China, and we need to have a U.S. presence to fall back on. We need to have that to show the Chinese this is a, you know, what you want, your vision.
And they made a ton of
Western luxury
in China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the answer to your question is both. Honestly, I think that it's a recipe for disaster if either of them fails in either of those two markets.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think I'm not talking failure. I'm just talking not success at the level that we might want to think that they might be successful in this market. And I just
I don't think either of them will have that level of success in this market for 15 years yet. Well, I have a much longer horizon.
And by the way, Cadillac's already been, you know, reborn for about 15 years,
yeah.
Right? This is their second shot.
And they're barely halfway there, and Lincoln's just starting.
Yeah.
The products are there. It's the brand image. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Why do people buy Mercedes? Because it's a Mercedes.
120 years Mercedes.
So this there was a story that Kyle Stock wrote in Bloomberg, and it was very interesting, basically on the thesis of whether some of these luxury brands like Audi, BMW, and Mercedes are not becoming too big, and pointing out that they sold 1.3 million vehicles worldwide. In the first 3 months of this year, which is 9% more than the year earlier. And they quote in the story this person, Laura Koslow, who says, quote, the issue in luxury is people don't always want the number one selling vehicle. They don't want to be one of many. They want to be one of few. Is there a danger that these Mercedes, Audi, BMW, I saw that Porsche came out with a release saying that Porsche AG delivered 20,222 new cars worldwide in March 2015 with an increase of 31.5% year over year.
Okay. But it's about density to me. It's not about the actual number. If you're going into new markets and your products are available to a new group of consumers that they weren't available to before, for instance, if you're pushing heavily into China where, you know, their middle class is growing and their upper class is growing and you're not going to see that saturation, it's a question of, are you pulling up to the valet stand and are you seeing you know, 12 other S-classes that look just like yours? Or is yours still the only S-class, you know, on your block?
But could it be if you know, you have an S-class and Mark has a CLA?
Don't hate me.
Pshaw.
No, but
yeah.
That is the question. You're absolutely right.
I think the
brand stretch that far? And can the brand stretch to include, you know, little delivery vans like they sell in Europe? Can they do that in the rest of the world? Mercedes says it's going to build a pickup, a midsize pickup shared with what will probably be the next generation Nissan Frontier. I mean, they haven't said they're going to sell it here yet, but at what point do the brands, is there a point at which these brands stretch so far that they snap?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been driving something that points to there's being a ceiling on that. I had the S600 Maybach this week. And Maybach was a standalone division before when basically Mercedes sort of caved to the fact that it couldn't stretch that far in the marketplace anymore. It didn't have that mm-hmm. reputation for quality necessarily or luxury at that point in its career. So it came out with this new super luxury brand. Didn't work. Cost them, you know, right. hundreds of millions of dollars. And so now they've rolled the Maybach brand back in under, you know, the S-Class, basically. And so it's a stretched S-Class with a couple of different things that say Maybach on it. But mm-hmm. it's effectively, you know, just a $200,000 S-Class with more toys and a
right.
little bit more legroom.
So, all right. I want to change this to something completely different, okay? So sometimes I wonder whether, you know, writing about the auto industry and talking about the auto industry and dealing with the auto industry, and then you see all the interest in things like iPads and iPhones and whatnot, that we may be getting to a place where the culture that we're dealing with and the culture that we're interested in is not as interesting to younger people, that we may be losing something. And so I saw that the new Fast and Furious movie, Fast and Furious 7, is the highest grossing film in that franchise. Two weekends, and ticket sales were in excess of $800 million worldwide, and they believe they're gonna break $1 billion this weekend. Okay, so here's the question that I have to you guys, and I actually have the answer to this question. But so is it that young people are interested in this and they're going to see the Fast and Furious movie, or is it a bunch of aging people who look at those vehicles and say, you know what, that's what I drove when I was young, or that's what I wanted to drive when I was young? What do you think?
No, I think it's that now that all the, we have ArcLight Theater, it now costs $80 for a family of four to go to the movies. That's what I think it is.
So that's why it was such a high-grossing film. All right, come on. That's, what do you think?
I think to most kids, I think the cars in that movie are as far out as an X-Wing's fighter was in Star Wars when we saw it. Mm-hmm. And they love them, and they love the movies. But I think it's more the experience of the movie. And it probably does have a little bit of a reflected glow for the cars and the companies involved as well. Mm-hmm. But I think it's fantasy. It is presumably, one would hope anyway, you know, good smash-em-up entertainment.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I have a little first-hand experience with this because I actually went and saw this movie. And I will, to be perfectly honest with you, it's the first Fast and the Furious movie that I've seen outside of the very first one in the theater. I'm not a fan of this franchise at all. I think it's, you know.
Did you lose a bet?
No, you know what? I had read so many positive reviews about it. The you know, the Metacritic type scores were significantly higher than anything in recent memory. And I
Was
thought.
Was it a tribute to Paul Walker?
And I think that it's probably a little bit of that nostalgia and that look back and the respect for him as an actor and that loss. It was not a very good movie.
No.
I'll be perfectly honest with you. It patently was not. The acting was bad. The script was bad. The special effects were good, but obviously completely, you know, fantastical and unbelievable. Mm-hmm. This is my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you, I sat in a absolutely packed IMAX theater. And I felt like I was among the oldest people there.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was, Aaron and I were, just drove the Fiat 500X, which we can't talk about. So sorry, Aaron, we're going to talk about this next week when you're not in that little box on the screen. So I talked to Scott Brown, who does PR for FCA on the West Coast, and he was telling me that he had the sublime green and black 2015 Dodge Challenger RT, mm-hmm. which is driven by the character Letty in the movie, which apparently for whatever reason, has iron bits welded outside because
it's like a rally cross version or lifted. You know, if you looked at the rally fighter from Local Motors, it's kind of like that. It's got extra ground clearance and knobby tires. And you know what? That was the coolest vehicle in the whole movie because you're like, you know what? That works. Uh-huh. I could totally see that being a real thing.
So he said that he actually had that car. And there was a big Mopar rally that goes on. It's a big annual event out in California. And he was able to drive that car to the rally. And he said that the older people are like, you know, what the hell did they do to that car? You know, they messed up. That's a brand new car that they messed up by putting that stuff on it. And all the kids, that obviously doesn't have the stuff on it, for those of you who are watching, it's the correct color, though, that all the kids were coming up to him and demanding that they have pictures taken with the car.
It's great. Yeah.
So obviously we have this whole, you know, we spent most of the show talking about electric vehicles. These people are interested in V8s, I think.
They're interested in speed.
Speed
and fun.
Yeah, I agree.
So it doesn't matter how you get the speed?
No, there's probably a heavy percentage of Japanese cars in that movie, historically. You know, things like a S2000 or a GTR or a WRX. Mm. They brought in some of the traditional American muscle for the guys like Vin Diesel and all that. And I know way too much about this movie now.
I think we're
my apologies,
clearly.
Everybody.
But
he only says he saw the first one.
Yeah. Where is this on the Vin Diesel spectrum?
I was going to say Kindergarten Cop, but I don't even think that was Vin Diesel, so I can't really help you out there. But I think there's that respect for that, especially now that some of the Chrysler cars are, you know, pretty cool again and drawing in at least eyeballs, if not younger pocketbooks. But I think it's still largely centered around that Japanese import tuner culture.
And let's not forget, and I haven't seen the movie because, you know, I have some self-respect, but let's not forget that the people who were into those tuner cars when the first movie came out, well, they're now, what, 10, 12 years older? So, you know, it's almost a bit of nostalgia for them, you know? Mm-hmm.
That's scary and sad.
Yes, but I think it's encouraging that we're seeing people have interesting, you know, they're interested in car culture, so...
Sure.
And there's a new Mad Max movie coming.
And
because Hollywood is completely out of ideas.
That's true, but, I mean, if we're talking about big, spectacular car chase movies, it doesn't get better than a good Mad Max movie. I want to see that.
So
I'm a big fan of the original Gone in 60 Seconds. It doesn't get better than that for car chases.
But Mark likes the post-apocalyptic thing, and so he's more interested in that.
Take
all right,
to Thunderdome.
There you go. So he wants. So with that will be the final word on today's show. So I want to thank you guys for being here. So Aaron Gold, cars.about.com, Sherman Oaks, California.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for being here or being there and being here at the same time. But that's
in my little box.
In your little box.
And your little dog, too.
In your little dog that some may or may not see.
She's finally given up and gone to sleep, but she spent a lot of time standing right next to me, staring at me, going, why aren't you petting me?
Yeah. I thought she might be whining listening to the show, but that's another story entirely. Chris Paukert, automotive freelancer, thank you for being here and for manning the iPad.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Mark Phelan, Detroit Free Press. And for those of you who don't read Mark at Free Press, he may not live in Detroit because freep.com, and you were talking earlier about the queue system and interfaces and stuff like that. And I always find I learn lots about interfaces and cars because of your reviews.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
I do that all the time. So freep.com for you. We can find you how?
I'm all over the place right now. I'm doing some things for Automotive News, for KBB, for Edmonds. So,
you can find me on
Twitter at CP Autoscribe if you so desire.
CP
Autoscribe. Yeah.
Autoscribe, all one word. Okay, do that. I'm at autofuelguide.com. Friend Autoline at facebook.com/Autoline Network, all one word, Autoline Network. Follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. So thanks for joining us today, and we'll be back here next week. So thank you very much.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.